Chapter 9. After some exploration, they tracked down a rerun of The Young and the Doomed, 1890, to a tiny theater that specialized in painted westerns, as those deserts of non-art used to be called. Thus had Mademoiselle La Rivière's Enfant Maudit, 1887, finally degenerated. She had had two adolescents in a French castle poison their widowed mother, who had seduced a young neighbor, the lover of one of her twins. The author had made many concessions to the freedom of the times and the foul fancy of scriptwriters, but both she and the leading lady disavowed the final result of multiple tamperings with the plot that had now become the story of a murder in Arizona, the victim being a widower about to marry an alcoholic prostitute, whom Marina, quite sensibly, refused to impersonate. But poor little Ada had clung to her bit part, a two-minute scene in a traktir, roadside tavern. During the rehearsals, she felt she was doing not badly as a serpentine barmaid, until the director blamed her for moving like an angular backfish. She had not deigned to see the final product and was not over-eager to have Van see it now, but he reminded her that the same director, G.A. Vronsky, had told her she was always pretty enough to serve one day as a stand-in for Lenore Colleen, who at 20 had been as attractively gauche as she, raising and tensing forward her shoulders in the same way when crossing a room. Having sat through a preliminary PW short, they finally got to The Young and the Doomed, only to discover that the barmaid scene of the barroom sequence had been cut out, except for a perfectly distinct shadow of Ada's elbow, as Vaughn kindly maintained. Next day, in their little drawing room with its black divan, yellow cushions, and draft-proof bay, whose new window seemed to magnify the slow, steady, straight-falling snowflakes, coincidentally stylized on the cover of the current issue of The Beau and the Butterfly, which lay on the window ledge, Ada discussed her dramatic career. The whole matter secretly nauseated Vaughn, so that, by contrast, her natural history passion acquired a nostalgic splendor. For him, the written word existed only in its abstract purity, in its unrepeatable appeal to an equally ideal mind. It belonged solely to its creator, and could not be spoken or enacted by a mime, as Ada insisted, without letting the deadly stab of another's mind destroy the artist in the very lair of his art. A written play was intrinsically superior to the best performance of it, even if directed by the author himself. Otherwise, Vaughn agreed with Ada that the talking screen was certainly preferable to the live theater, for the simple reason that with the former, a director could attain and maintain his own standards of perfection throughout an unlimited number of performances. Neither of them could imagine the partings that her professional existence on location might necessitate, and neither could imagine their traveling together to Argus-eyed destinations and living together in Hollywood, USA, or Ivydale, England, or the sugar-white Konritz Hotel in Cairo. To tell the truth, they did not imagine any life at all beyond their present tableau vivant in the lovely dove-blue Manhattan sky. At 14, Ada had firmly believed she would shoot to stardom, and there, with a grand bang, break into prismatic tears of triumph. She studied at special schools, unsuccessful but gifted actresses, as well as Stanislavski, no relation and not a stage name, gave her private lessons of drama, despair, hope. Her debut was a quiet little disaster. Her subsequent appearances were sincerely applauded only by close friends. "One's first love," she told Vaughn, "is one's first standing ovation. And that is what makes great artists. So Stan and his girlfriend, who played Miss Spangled Triangle in Flying Rings, assured me, actual recognition may come only with the last wreath."
"Bosh," said Vaughn.
"Precisely. He too was hooted by hack hoods in much older Amsterdams, and look how 300 years later every poppy group pup copies him. I still think I have talent, but then maybe I'm confusing the right podhood approach with talent, which does not give a dry fig for rules deduced from past art."
"Well, at least you know that," said Vaughn, "and you've dwelt at length upon it in one of your letters." I seem to have always felt, for example, that acting should be focused not on characters, not on types of something or other, not on the focus-pocus of a social theme, but exclusively on the subjective and unique poetry of the author. Because playwrights, as the greatest among them has shown, are closer to poets than to novelists. In real life, we are creatures of chance in an absolute void, unless we be artists ourselves, naturally. But in a good play, I feel authored. I feel passed by the board of censors. I feel secure, with only a breathing blackness before me, instead of our fourth wall time. I feel cuddled in the embrace of puzzled Will. He thought I was you. Or in that of the much more normal Anton Pavlovich, who was always passionately fond of long dark hair. That you also wrote to me once. The beginning of Ada's Lyme life in 1891 happened to coincide with the end of her mother's 25-year-long career. What is more, both appeared in Chekhov's Four Sisters. Ada played Irina on the modest stage of the Yakima Academy of Drama in a somewhat abridged version, which, for example, kept only the references to Sister Varvara, the garrulous Originalka, odd female, as Marcia calls her, but eliminated her actual scenes, so that the title of the play might have been The Three Sisters, as indeed it appeared in the wittier of the local notices. It was the somewhat expanded part of the nun that Marina acted in an elaborate film version of the play, and the picture and she received a goodly amount of undeserved praise. "Ever since I planned to go on the stage," said Ada, we are using her notes, "I was haunted by Marina's mediocrity, oh dear que la critique, which either ignored her or lumped her in the common grave with other adequate sustainers. Or, if the role had sufficient magnitude, the gamut went from wooden to sensitive, the highest compliment her accomplishments had ever received. And here she was, at the most delicate moment of my career, multiplying and sending out to friends and foes such exasperating comments as, 'Durmanova is superb as the neurotic nun, having transferred an essentially static and episodical part into... etc., etc., etc.' Of course, the cinema has no language problems," continued Ada, while Vaughn swallowed rather than stifled a yawn. "Marina and three of the men did not need the excellent dubbing which the other members of the cast, who lacked the lingo, were provided with. But our wretched Yakima production could rely on only two Russians, Stan's protege, Altschuler, in the role of Baron Nikolai Lvovich Tusenbach Krona Altschauer, and myself as Irina, la pauvre et noble enfant, who is a telegraph operator in one act, a town council employee in another, and a schoolteacher in the end. All the rest had a macédoine of accents, English, French, Italian. By the way, what's the Italian for window?"
"Finestra, sestra," said Vaughn, mimicking a mad prompter.
Irina, sobbing, Where has it all gone? Oh dear, oh dear, all is forgotten, forgotten, muddled up in my head. I don't remember the Italian for ceiling, or, say, window."
"No, window comes first in that speech," said Vaughn, "because she looks around and then up, in the natural movement of thought."
"Yes, of course. Still wrestling with window, she looks up and is confronted by the equally enigmatic ceiling. In fact, I'm sure I played it your psychological way. But what does it matter? What did it matter? The performance was perfectly odious. My Baron kept fluffing every other line, but Marina was marvelous in her world of shadows. 10 years and one have gone by since I left Moscow."
Ada, now playing Varvara, copied the nun's sing-songy devotional tone, «Pevushchi ton bogomolki», as indicated by Chekhov and as rendered so irritatingly well by Marina.
"Nowadays, old Basmayana Street, where you," turning to Irina, "were born a score of yearkins, Godkov, ago, is Busman Road, lined on both sides with workshops and garages." Irina tries to control her tears.
Why then should you want to go back, Arinushka?
Irina sobs in reply. Naturally, as would every fine player, Mother improvised quite a bit, bless her soul. And moreover, her voice, in young, tuneful Russian, is substituted for Lenore's corny brogue.
Vaughn had seen the picture and had liked it. An Irish girl, the infinitely graceful and melancholy Lenore Colleen,
O qui me rendra ma Colleen, et le grand chêne, and my Colleen.
Harrowingly resembled Ada Ardus as photographed with her mother in Belladonna, a movie magazine which Greg Erminen had sent him, thinking it would delight him to see aunt and cousin together on a California patio just before the film was released. Varvara, the late General Sergei Prozorov's eldest daughter, comes in Act One from her remote nunnery, Tsitsikar Convent, to Perm, also called Perm Whale, in the backwoods of Akhimsk Bay, North Kennedy, to have tea with Olga, Marcia, and Irina on the latter's name day. Much to the nun's dismay, her three sisters dream only of one thing, leaving cool, damp, mosquito-infested, but otherwise nice and peaceful, permanent, as Irina mockingly dubs it, for high life in remote and sinful Moscow, Idaho, the former capital of Estotiland. In the first edition of his play, which never quite manages to heave the soft sigh of a masterpiece, Chekhov, as he spelled his name when living that year at the execrable Pension Riche 9, Rue Gounod, Nice, crammed into the two pages of a ludicrous expository scene all the information he wished to get rid of, great lumps of recollections and calendar dates, an impossible burden to place on the fragile shoulders of three unhappy Estoti women. Later, he redistributed that information through a considerably longer scene, in which the arrival of the monashka, Varvara, provides all the speeches needed to satisfy the restless curiosity of the audience. This was a neat stroke of stagecraft, but unfortunately, as so often occurs in the case of characters brought in for disingenuous purposes, the nun stayed on, and not until the third, penultimate act was the author able to bundle her off back to her convent.
I assume, said Vaughn, knowing his girl, that you did not want any tips from Marina for your Irina?
It would have only resulted in a row. I always resented her suggestions because they were made in a sarcastic, insulting manner. I've heard mother birds going into neurotic paroxysms of fury and mockery when their poor little tailless ones, Mikhvostye Bednuyishki, were slow in learning to fly. I've had enough of that.
By the way, here's the program of my flop.
Vaughn glanced through the list of players and DPs and noticed two amusing details. The role of Fedotic, an artillery officer whose comedy organ consists of a constantly clicking camera, had been assigned to a Kim, short for Yakim, Eskimosov, and somebody called John Starling had been cast as Skvortsov, a secundant in the rather amateurish duel of the last act, whose name comes from Skvorets, Starling. When he communicated the latter observation to Ada, she blushed, as was her old world wont.
Yes, she said. He was quite a lovely lad, and I sort of flirted with him, but the strain and the split were too much for him. He had been, since pubescence, the puerulus of a fat ballet master, Dangleleaf, and he finally committed suicide. You see, the blush now replaced by a Matovaya pallor. I'm not hiding one strain of what rhymes with perm.
I see. And Yakim?
Oh, he was nothing.
No, I mean, Yakim, at least, did not, as his rhymesake did, take a picture of your brother embracing his girl, played by Don Dallaire?
I'm not sure. I seem to recall that our director did not mind some comic relief.
Don, en robe rose vert, at the end of Act One.
I think there was a click in the wings and some healthy mirth in the house. All poor Starling had to do in the play was to hello off stage from a rowboat on the Kama River to give the signal for my fiancée to come to the dueling ground.
But let us shift to the didactic metaphorism of Chekhov's friend Count Tolstoy. We all know those old wardrobes and old hotels in the old world subalpine zone. At first one opens them with the utmost care, very slowly, in the vain hope of hushing the excruciating creak, the growing groan that the door emits midway. Before long one discovers, however, that if it is opened or closed with celerity, in one resolute sweep, the hellish hinge is taken by surprise, and triumphant silence achieved. Vaughn and Ada, for all the exquisite and powerful bliss that engulfed and repleted them, and we do not mean here the rose sore of Eros alone, knew that certain memories had to be left closed, lest they wrench every nerve of the soul with their monstrous moan. But if the operation is performed swiftly, if indelible evils are mentioned between two quick quips, there is a chance that the anesthetic of life itself may allay unforgettable agony in the process of swinging its door. Now and then she poked fun at his sexual peccadillos, though generally she tended to ignore them, as if demanding, by tacit implication, a similar kind of leniency in regard to her frailty. He was more inquisitive than she, but hardly managed to learn more from her lips than he had from her letters. To her past admirers, Ada attributed all the features and faults we have already been informed of, incompetence of performance, inanity and nonentity, and to her own self, nothing beyond easy, feminine compassion and such considerations of hygiene and sanity as hurt Vaughn more than would a defiant avowal of passionate betrayal. Ada had made up her mind to transcend his and her sensual sins, the adjective being a near synonym of senseless and soulless, and therefore not represented in the ineffable hereafter that both our young people mutely and shyly believed in. Vaughn endeavored to follow the same line of logic, but could not forget the shame and the agony, even while reaching heights of happiness he had not known at his brightest hour, before his darkest one in the past.